For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We're in Galatians, beginning of a study that will take us through the end of the year, to be sure. And tonight we want to just kind of get your feet wet in this letter and talk about Christianity as it is really at the crossroads of emerging. Galatians is the first letter of the New Testament written, so you get a real window into things from that point of view. Let's take a look at our text. Galatians 1:1. It says, this is a letter from Paul. So that tells you something. It's from Paul. And he is an apostle. He says, I was not appointed by any group of people or any human authority, but by Jesus Christ himself and by God the Father who raised Jesus from the dead. All the brothers and sisters here, join me in sending this letter to the churches of Galatia. May God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ give you grace and peace. Let's just draw the line right there for a second, get up to speed on what's happening in this letter. Some background. The letter's from Paul the Apostle, he says, to the churches in Galatia. And just to understand a little bit about that, Galatia's modern-day Turkey. Okay, just so you got that geographical thing going. And Paul went from Antioch, which is basically modern-day Syria, up into what is now Turkey, and he began proclaiming the message of Christ. It was his first missionary journey. And so he made a loop around through Turkey, and there are a number of churches, many churches that were established. He went back through and revisited these same groups, and then he came home. And when he came home, he wrote this letter to these people. And I think it's a real sweet window into the earliest Christianity. You know, I just, maybe this is an issue for you, maybe it's not. But every year, and often several times through the year, you know, people are writing these articles and they make headlines about, you know, what is the real message of Christianity and stuff like that. So Newsweek has this thing called The World of the Nativity, and they're asking the question, you know, did Jewish culture affect Christianity? Duh. Here's one, The Birth of Jesus, Faith in History and How the Story of Christmas Came to Be. So it's taken a couple thousand years, but they finally figured it out. This is how it came to be. And how Jesus became the Christ, that's very interesting. And so there is this sort of the feeling that, you know, what is Christianity after all? And can we kind of figure out the real Christianity from the 2,000 years of tradition that have surrounded Christianity? And I think in some ways, that's really a great question. And it is a question that Paul, in this letter, is really intensely interested in. Like I said, this is the first letter of the New Testament written. There is no New Testament in existence. And Paul writes this letter to these churches in Galatia, and this is like the first deposit. This is even before the Gospels were written. Paul writes his letter to the Galatians, and so it answers in a critical way, I think, this question. You know, what is the earliest, clearest teaching about what is Christianity? If we want to strip back the veneer and the layers of tradition and say, what is the real message? There's no better possible place to be than Galatians. And so some of us here tonight have been maybe affected a lot by the musings and the questions of the History Channel and of these, you know, mainstream publications and stuff like that. And we're wondering, you know, yeah, how do you know what is the message of Christianity? And what is, you know, Christianity apart from what the church has done to it over the centuries and stuff like that? What a great place to begin that investigation. Read the book of Galatians for yourself. We're going to go kind of paragraph by paragraph over the next few months, and we're going to try to trace out what is the early message of Christianity. We want to also note a very important piece of history, which is that Galatians is written primarily to Gentiles, and that becomes like a real big deal as we get into the letter, that Christianity began, of course, Jesus' disciples were Jewish, and Jesus himself was Jewish, and the church in Jerusalem was Jewish, And now all of a sudden, we've got lots of non-Jewish people. That's what a Gentile is. Most of you are guilty here of being a Gentile. And so this letter really is written for you, and is written kind of from the standpoint of what do people without any kind of background in terms of the God of the Bible, the Old Testament, you know, what kind of questions does a person like that have about the Christian message? And so in that way, again, I think that the message of Galatians is super interesting. And from the historical point of view, this concern about the clash of cultures is very prominent, because these Galatian churches are mixes of primarily Gentile, but also Jewish members. And these are people who, if you read through Acts, which is the history of the early church, Acts chapters 13, 14, and 15, you get sort of a historical overview of this missionary journey that Paul is now writing about in the book of Galatians. So that's sort of interesting. And what Luke, who wrote Acts and who is a companion of Paul, points out is that Paul would go from city to city through Galatia, and because he was himself a rabbi, Paul was Jewish, he would go into the synagogues and he would argue the case for Christianity from the Old Testament. And Jewish people, many would respond to what he had to say, many would not, but there were these group of people in first century Rome and in their empire who are referred to as God-fearers. These are people who are not Jewish, they're Gentile, but they're attracted to Judaism because this idea of the one true God and the God who actually reveals himself in history and can be known and this type of thing, that was very attractive to these people. So they would literally stand outside the synagogue on Sabbath and they would listen in through the window. And a lot of these people responded to Paul's message, which is called the gospel, the good news about Christ. And they were forming these little communities. I hesitate to use the word church because for many of us this will elicit in our thinking something really foreign to the New Testament world. There are groups of people, several dozen often, meeting in homes, meeting in larger venues sort of like this, but devoid of any kind of real ritual and this type of thing. And for the Jewish people who are really all about the ritual and for whom that's very familiar and comforting, it's like, you know, wait a second now. How does this fit in with everything that I've known and been taught? And plus, these Gentiles, they do the most disgusting things. They eat food that was sacrificed, for instance, in a pagan temple. They eat food that our dietary codes from the Old Testament expressly forbid. And they do all these things, and so all that anti-Semitism from the Gentile side and the suspicion of Gentiles by the Jews, they come together literally under one roof, and you've got a real potentially explosive situation going on. And so Paul has to talk about how Christianity is an umbrella plenty big enough for both Jew and Gentile background believers to experience Christ. And so that's going to be very much a part of the story as it begins to unfold. Now I want to talk a little bit about the major kind of elements that make up the letter, the main ideas, which center on controversy. This is, as we'll see when we get into the first paragraph here in just a minute, wow! And there is definitely a fight going on, and Paul definitely has an opinion about that. The controversy surrounds first the question, is Christianity Jewish? Okay? It's established by a Jewish Messiah and fulfillment of the Jewish scripture, and all of the apostles themselves are Jewish, and so it seems like it's all about Judaism, and there are these people, in fact, that were going around after Paul would go from town to town. They'd kind of sneak up behind him after he had left. These guys would show up. They're called Judaizers. And so from the term, you can kind of get an idea that it has something to do with Judaism. And it does. The Judaizers were people who were basically arguing that since Christianity is rooted in Judaism, that you have to become a Jew first before you can become a Christian. And for a lot of the Gentiles, this was a big problem. Because, for instance, Gentiles in the Roman world were not circumcised. Jews universally are circumcised. And so it makes the price of admission really high for some people. And plus, there's all these dietary codes and all this kind of stuff going on, and it's creating real problems. Paul needs to be able to ferret this out. Clearly, Christianity is rooted in Judaism. In that sense, it is Jewish. It's authentically Jewish. And yet, at the same time, he wants to argue that Christianity is not Judaism. It's a message for all of humanity that embraces every culture and every ethnicity. It's a big deal. Second, is grace, which is the central message of Christianity, we'll read it here in a minute, it's called the good news, the idea that God has a gift, that the way we approach God is on the basis of what he's done for us, not all the good stuff that we do for him. And that raises some questions. Is grace really enough to be reconciled with God? And is grace a sufficient basis to go on in a life that is pleasing to God? And we'll see why that's controversial here, I think, in just a second. And then here's the big question, the question that you may have in your mind too. Okay, these are very big issues. The whole definition of Christianity, the meaning of and application of its message. That's what points 1 and 2 are. And Paul is going to take what to most religiously minded people is a very radical, in fact, revolutionary point of view about this. And it elicits from the people that he is engaging in debate the explicit accusation, well, who is Paul after all? And who can say about these matters? Who speaks for Christianity? And so I think, you know, these questions are great questions. They're interesting, certainly from the historical point of view. It enables us to read articles like this a lot more carefully, a lot more critically. But very importantly, there are applications for us as well, right here, that are beyond just the interesting, abstract, historical questions. Because just like in the first century world, where Christianity was engaging Jewish culture, and this question is being raised, is Christianity, you know, the possession of one particular culture, one particular ethnic group, namely the Jewish people? I think in our day, many of us grapple with this question, is the Christian message largely lost in cultural baggage? It's been my experience in talking to people who are churchgoers or who have a rich history of churchgoing in their background that what they conceive Christianity to be and what Paul and the rest of the New Testament will tell us Christianity is are fundamentally different things. I had that impression growing up in sort of a nominally church-going family. We went, you know, when we had to or when we were like in trouble or something like that, the kids. You know, I never really got it. It never was clear to me what Christianity was other than a bad time to get up on Sunday morning, to get dressed up in a way that I never would otherwise get dressed, to be around adults and strange smells and images and a message that was to me incomprehensible, followed by some motions, and then you were done. And so I thought, that's Christianity. No thanks. You know, and a lot of us kind of have that sense too, that for me to become a Christian, what does that mean? Does that mean that I have to become a Republican now or something like that? You know, we have all kinds of cultural definitions about what is a Christian today. And it's very easy for people to get confused about what is the message versus what is the cultural form that many Christians put Christianity in. We need to be able to differentiate those things. And I think that we'll find that there's something super refreshing and very, very different that Paul is describing in this letter than anything that you have experienced in your kind of the church experience that you may have had. Second, and this gets to the second point, is grace sufficient? You know, I think that many of us, maybe subtly and maybe not so subtly, have gotten the impression, the understanding that the Christian life is basically about being a do-gooder, being a good person, being nice, things of this nature. That, of course, you know, now that I'm a Christian, I have to, what is the expression, act like a Christian? Which is what? That I'm nice. I don't cuss, and I don't offend people, and I, you know, things of that nature. And what most Christians, I think, really don't get is the idea that we come into a relationship with God on the basis of grace. I'm going to describe that in a minute. But that same basis upon which we come into relationship with God, grace, is the very animating principle that drives our entire Christian life as well. And so not only do we come into relationship with God on the basis of grace, but we live fundamentally on the basis of God's grace. What does that look like? I think you'll find it to be interesting and refreshing. And then, of course, too, here's this point. What is the Bible's message? And this was very important to them. I think it's important to us, too. The people who are opposing Paul's message were people who were saying, okay, what you're saying then with this grace thing is that, you know, our moral code, the law of Moses from the Old Testament, these are Jewish people I'm talking about, no longer applies. Well, that's really weird. Are you saying that God at a certain point was working one way with people and he's saying, follow the rule book, here's the rules, it's all laid out, work hard, strive, be good. Here's this law, this is what tells you what good looks like. And then at some point, inexplicably, he changes his mind and says, ah, forget that, I've got a new plan, it's about grace. And the accusation was, and maybe you've thought about this too, that the message of the Old Testament and the God of the Old Testament is fundamentally different than the God and the message of the New Testament. Does that sound familiar to you? Have you wondered that question? How can we reconcile the Old Testament with all of its command and the God who's really angry and stuff like that with the New Testament, with the approachable God through Jesus? You know, it's all about love and this kind of thing. How do those things fit together? Well, that was a big problem for Paul's audience. And sometimes it's a problem for us. And we need to understand that Paul's going to argue powerfully, I think, in chapters 3 and 4 of this letter, that it's all the same message, Old Testament and New. And it's all about grace. And it always has been about grace. And so it's really fascinating. We'll see how that spins out. Okay. Where does the gospel begin? That's what we want to get into. Paul basically in verse 4 is going to summarize, this is the message that you guys heard from me. This is where it all started. This is the good news. He says in verse 4, Jesus gave his life for our sins just as God our Father planned. Okay, so the good news that Paul proclaimed centers on something that God has done for us. That the death of Christ is at the center point of God's plan for humanity. That we can kind of put a cross on a timeline and say everything that has been and will be hinges. This is the keystone to understanding the Bible. It's the keystone to understanding history. It's the keystone to understanding God's intents for humanity. It's the cross of Christ. Just as it says in Luke 24:44 that in Jesus, all of the Old Testament's message, the prophets, the Psalms, and the law of Moses have been fulfilled. That these were basically images of what God was going to do, and in Christ, boom, he does them. And that's the message that Paul is going to argue, I think, very powerfully, is that the cross of Christ, Jesus coming and dying on the cross, was no accident, but it was a part of what God had anticipated all along before he even created any human being. God, in his knowledge, knew the condition that humanity would find itself in, and it was a decision that he made, that he was going to enter into human history, and he was going to die on the cross for the sins of humanity. And that's not an accident. It's something consciously intended by God from the very beginning and animates our whole understanding of the Old Testament. What is the message then? What's the point of the cross? Why did Christ have to go to the cross? He says, in order to rescue us from this present evil age. And so what is the good news? The good news is the story of God's rescue. That's what it is. And so, for some people, I don't really feel like I need to be rescued. I'm doing just fine on my own. Well, okay. You have that freedom to view things in those terms. And in that sense, the gospel will mean very little to you. But at some point, I think that it occurs to us, man, I am in way over my head. I don't have the resources that I need in my life. I need rescued. Man, that came home to me this weekend. Okay, so I got my whole family, including some extended family, down to our little family cabin down in Burroughs State Park. It's this A-frame thing, right? Well, it's been there. You know, my dad had it built 40 years ago, right? And the same roof. Big problem. So, okay, we're down there. And we are re-roofing our house. Oh, my God. Okay, you'd have to see it to believe it. It's just an absurdity. I do have, however, a new skill, night roofing. It's true. And there's a spiritual message here, too. It's called roofing by faith, not by sight. Yeah, it works. It was clear, however, at the end of work yesterday, and we were all fried. Man, we are in way over our heads. And so, our buddy, who got us into this mess to begin with, called out the reinforcements, and along comes the four horsemen of the non-apocalypse, okay? And they knew what they were doing, and cha-boom, cha-bang, and this thing's just about done. At the very point, we're like, oh, this is insane. We'll never get this done. We got rescued. Okay. Well, now, okay, so maybe you've got an inkling of those kinds of experiences, but how about something a little deeper? How about that sense that maybe I realize that I have a problem, namely that I am alienated from God? How do I deal with the reality of my own guilt when I know that I can no longer continue to suppress it and to pretend that I'm basically okay because I compare myself to someone like Sarah and then I always end up looking better? But then Chris comes along and I'm like, oh man, yeah, I guess I really am that bad. And so we just realize that we come to the end of self-righteousness. I've got it all together. I'm sure God is very impressed with me and this type of thing. And we have that kind of sober awareness, you know, I'm not all that together. And there's a lot of things that I deeply resent about other people that end up being true of me. And the very things that I judge other people about, I'm guilty of. This type of thing. And we realize I can't change me. And if I'm going to approach God on the basis of my goodness, I think I've got a problem here. And it's at that point where we realize I need rescue. Because where I'm at in my life, it's way too late to think about being as good enough to be acceptable to God on the basis of my basic goodness. Way too late for that. And it's at that point then that the gospel really is good news. Because the gospel is, you are guilty before a holy God. We can't minimize God's character to accommodate our sinfulness, okay, like we maybe could with somebody else. His standard is way too high. And I'm basically, you know, I'm screwed at this point before God. Unless He is willing to move toward me. And the gospel, the good news, is that God has moved toward you in the person of Christ. And all of your guilt that is a barrier between yourself and God, He is completely taken out of the way in the cross. He died the death that you deserve and that I deserve. So that our guilt before God is no longer an occasion for separation between ourselves and Him. It is possible to be reconciled to God. It's possible to know God. It's possible, as Paul will say later in this letter, to have God immersed in our lives through His Spirit. And that we've become alive in a way that we have never become alive before. That is super good news. That's a great message. What are we rescued from? What are we rescued to? I like the way Paul puts it in Colossians 1. He says, He rescued us from the kingdom of darkness. Okay, the kingdom of darkness, a world that is just lost. It's confused. Doesn't have the answers for its own existence. For why does anything matter? For what do I do about the God thing? You know, that's darkness. Trying to roof in the dark, man. I do not recommend it. Okay? But from the standpoint of life, what Paul is saying is that this world is a kingdom of darkness. And we have little short-term solutions that make us kind of distracted and elated for a moment. And then we move on. Woodsy was talking about the guy who won the Powerball thing. So interesting. You know, if I had several hundred million dollars, what do I think my life would be like? It would be awesome. I could go wherever I want. I could do whatever I want. I would be the envy of all my peers, wouldn't I? Yeah, that's right. This guy realized, wait a minute, the only reason people move toward me at all is because they want my money. I'm no happier now than I ever was before. See, the value system that drives our world is a bunch of smoke and mirrors, a bunch of short-term solutions that don't really get to the heart of the matter. We want geographical solutions. We want circumstantial solutions. We want financial solutions. We want the relationship with that person who's just madly in love with us. That's darkness. That's darkness. And Paul says that in Christ we have been delivered from this kingdom of darkness to be under His loving, righteous rulership. He's dealt with our sin. We've become forgiven by Him. It's possible to walk in a completely different framework in our lives. It's deep and it's beautiful, and that's the good news. All right. Now let's get into the controversy a little bit here. Paul says in verse 6, I am shocked that you are turning away so soon from God who called you to Himself through the loving mercy of Christ. He says you're following a different way that pretends to be the good news, but it's not the good news at all. You're being fooled by those who deliberately twist the truth concerning Christ. Let God's curse fall on anybody, including us or an angel from heaven who preaches, who teaches a different kind of good news than the one that we preach to you. If anyone preaches a different good news than the one that you welcomed, let that person be cursed. Okay, now you kind of get the sense that this is not just a happy-go-lucky letter. You know, hi, how you doing? Sure do miss you guys. Wish you were here, you know, stuff like that. But this is a letter that addresses this deep controversy. Listen to the tone and the language. It's really kind of softened in English translations. He says, I'm shocked by you people. I can't believe that you're actually turning away from the very message that was communicated to you, that at one point was really great news to you, that you received eagerly. Because some people are coming in behind us and they're saying something very different. Namely, what are they saying? They're saying, it's good that Christ died for you. So you need to be forgiven by Him, and then to stay forgiven by God, what must you do? Be good. Follow the law. And if you fail to follow the law, you've got a real problem with God. Or God has a real problem with you. It's like the cross is sort of, let's erase the chalkboard and try again. Okay? That's what it is. That's what they were teaching. And Paul says, no way, man. No way. It's irreconcilable. You can't say on the one hand that we're completely forgiven by God on the basis of Christ, and then on the other hand that we have to earn it to stay in God's favor. No way. Those are two different messages. And what does he say to those people who have this grace plus being good to please God thing? Does he say, you know, they have a very interesting point of view. And I think we should be open-minded about these matters. And you should just kind of come to the whatever conclusion, you know, that you feel best about. Is that what Paul says? He says something different. And it, boy, does it come out in the original language. Not let them be cursed. What does that even mean? Does it mean you cuss at them? No, the word is anathema. It means may God damn you for leading people into a path that says that they have to earn their acceptance from God. That there's something evil in that message. Evil because that's not what God said. Evil because it trivializes what God has done in the cross, which he said was plenty, which was more than sufficient to deal with our problem of being sinful people in the face of a holy God. He has dealt with that problem. And so to say, well, yeah, but, and you got Christianity plus how you perform, how good you are, how nice you are, things like that, you don't have good news anymore. And you've basically said, thanks for dying on the cross, Jesus, but I'm going to go it on my own. And that will never work. No matter how religious you are, it just will never work. And so there's a fundamental controversy then over the question, is grace sufficient? And this whole letter is going to be there to really argue down this point. You know, the gospel is a scandal. It is a scandal. You know, it says that you are totally hopeless in yourself apart from Christ. Again, you know, you may think, well, I'm a pretty good person. I'm basically a good person. Basically a good person according to what standard? What standard? Your standard. Well, what makes your standard valuable at all? Why should God bow to your standard? God says, by my standard, which is the only standard that matters, he is God, you'll lose. You're not that good. And it's time that you took a fearless moral inventory and realized, you know, just how ungood you are. And for a lot of people, that's just really scandalous. It's like, you know, moi? Oui. Toi. I've been waiting for 25 years to use French in a CT. Okay. You're totally hopeless in yourself. You don't have the resources to please God. And that's scandalous because every religion there is says that's what you do. It's also scandalous to say that you are totally acceptable to God in Christ. Totally acceptable. You know, even people like Ken, totally acceptable. Totally acceptable today. totally acceptable yesterday and indeed totally acceptable tomorrow. We know what you're doing tonight. It's a problem, but you are forgiven. And a lot of people think, oh, no, wait a minute, that's not fair. Not only is that not fair, oh, my God. If we are totally acceptable to God on the basis of what he does, then what? You ever thought about that? Then what? Oh, man. Anything? I can do anything? Anything? Oh, yeah, anything. Well, doesn't that then mean anything goes? It would be like going to whatever the correctional facility is closest to. Isn't there a Supermax near Central Ohio somewhere? Lucasville. And just opening up those maximum security cells. You're forgiven. You're forgiven. You're forgiven. You're forgiven. Well, what kind of a world is that? Does that sound like a world that you would like to live in? And this is the objection to Christianity, the basic objection to grace. If we basically say that you are completely acceptable to God, not on the basis of what you do, but on the basis of what Christ has done for you, then it's possible that we could do all kinds of terrible things. Now, what would happen if we went to the local meeting of the Mensa Society? Do you know what the Mensa Society is? This is the Society for Geniuses, okay? Geniuses. And we took all those geniuses and we locked them up in prison. Ah, I want out. It's not fair. Okay, you're right, not fair. Let's go and unlock all those cells. Are we afraid of what's going to happen if we let geniuses walk the street? Are we afraid of that? Well, maybe you are. I don't know. Why are we afraid of the hardened criminal walking the streets but not the genius society? Why? Because we sense something substantially different about the two, right? What is that difference? Well, I'm just going to let you stew in that for a while. Because we're going to come back to this. This is the big issue that Paul had to answer. If grace is truly free, what about the results? What about the consequences? Big deal. It's a scandal. The uniqueness of the gospel is this, that God is truly satisfied in his justice in the death of Christ. If God does not turn a blind eye to human sin, he deals with it punitively. But the good news is that he has dealt with it punitively himself, so that you don't have to stand under the judgment of God. How do we reconcile in our minds a God that is absolutely just and a God that is absolutely loving? How do we do that? It's the gospel. It's God saying, I will not step back on my standards. And where there is guilt, there must be punishment. And yet I will pay the price. I will take that punishment on myself. The greatest act of justice was also the greatest act of love. Very profound, very deep. And then finally, what's at stake with the gospel? Okay, this is an important controversy. It affects the way that we think about God and how we relate to God. What's at stake with us who've met God through Jesus Christ already? And here, we're going to need to understand, and we're going to be tracing this out over several weeks, about this idea that grace, the good news, is not just justification, the idea that God has dealt with our moral problem before him. That's what justification is, to be made just before God. But we also want to ask this question, what does grace mean from the standpoint of how do I live my whole life? And what does it mean for me to be animated by the power of God's love in my life? And that's grace. And it's a deep thing. It's an important thing. And it's something that I think that we struggle with. Do you struggle with the gospel? That's a question I want to throw out on the table. Do you struggle with this thought that we completely stand under God's unmerited favor? Do we struggle with the thought that the grace of God in a consistent way applies to me? What do you think? I'm going to put forth the idea here that we are almost all law livers in one way or another. That our first impulse is extremely not grace-oriented. How would you know? Here's the question, and we just need to talk about it for a couple of minutes. How would you know if you did not really understand grace? And if you didn't understand the dynamic role that grace plays in your life? What would be a symptom of that? Who's got a thought? You wouldn't be able to apply it. That's definitely true.
Well, I was thinking that you'd be very judgmental.
Okay. Why would you be judgmental?
Well, because you would be thinking that you stood at a certain standard, mm-hmm. even though you fall far short of that.
Yes.
But and you expect other people to adhere to that standard.
That's right. And we could snub our nose at them when they don't, because that makes me feel like I'm doing a little bit better already. So there's that comparative thing going on. I think that's absolutely right. Is anyone like that here? Judgmental of other people? Maybe we resent their successes and blame them for their failures. What would that be? Oh, that's judgmental. That's the law. What else? Who else has a thought? What do you think?
I know that for a long time, I would, and actually still today, I would have these thoughts where if I had sort of an ongoing sin, I would be sort of terrified of dying in the midst of that sin.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and
how embarrassing to come in the face of God with this going on in my mind.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, especially if it's something that was very chronic and I was very aware of. And what kind of, the only thing that really sort of nips that in the bud is the thought of, well, at what point in my life am I not sinning? Is there ever a point where, whether it's conscious or not conscious, whether it's sort of a mindset or a belief or whatever, that I can safely die and not be in sin? And of course the answer is no, but you know.
Okay. There is the fear of what happens to me at the moment that I die, okay? That's deep. I had not thought about that. I'm a shallow guy. What about you? What do you think, Laurel?
Well, I think it becomes very difficult to recognize anything that you do wrong or anything.
Oh, okay. Why is that? Can't admit your faults.
You're afraid. You're very insecure. Because what if there's something wrong with you? Then.
And that I can't fix it. Yeah. And that what I do defines my value. Yeah. Yeah, that's a big problem. That's an American achiever problem. What do you think, Melissa?
I was going to say the flip side of that, where you are constantly measuring yourself to everything, and you are demoralized and defeated.
Yeah, so there's that chronic sense of I don't stack up, I'm a crappy employee, I'm a crappy spouse. I sure as heck hope my friends don't know how crappy of a parent I am. There's all this kind of stuff. And it can run us into the ground. We can become very neurotic, actually, about that. And for that reason, can become very fake in how we project ourselves to other people. Because if they really knew what I'm about, oh my God, you know, they wouldn't like me anymore, or they might judge me, kind of like the way I judge them. All right, okay, Deb, what do you think?
I think it makes people isolated and alone.
Yes. Why?
Kind of for the same thing Melissa and the other lady were talking about, fear of someone getting to know them and then just not wanting to know anyone else because you don't want to get involved.
Okay, so that can work two ways, can it?
Yeah.
I'm not acceptable, so I need to keep my distance, okay? The other side of it is, of course, they're not acceptable. That's right, which is oftentimes the case. All right. Kelly, what do you think?
My thought is because the gospel is all about forgiveness, you wouldn't have forgiveness for anything that anybody did to you or that you did to yourself. You know, you're constantly...
What a huge issue that is, this bitterness thing that that people just have floating from relationship to relationship. And the hypocrisy of saying, I want to be forgiven by God, but I refuse to forgive that other person. Yeah, it's a big problem. What do you think, Jen? You got a thought?
Going to the question of, do you struggle with the gospel? And you think, oh, it's a really neat idea that everyone is equal in God's eyes under grace and everyone can be forgiven equally until somebody hurts you, your family, or a friend. And it's like... Right. You know, say someone injures your child intentionally, that person can have the same forgiveness as your innocent child. So it's like, it's easy conceptually until it gets personal with
that's right. That's such a great
point.
Those that
have wronged you, maybe.
Absolutely. We can get this in the abstract, but when it comes right down to my life, it's a very different proposition completely. I totally agree. That's a great point. And but I feel like what they do... You know, to serve Christ is sort of like a drudgery, a duty. Do we struggle from a chronic sense of being burnt out? Like this is such a sacrifice to serve these people who are messing with my peace, this type of thing. Anybody like that? Didn't think so. Okay. I think that sense of what animates us to serve and to love and to lay down our lives like Christ did, you will never, ever, ever get that until you get grace. And a lot of us are kind of just like thinking about the Christian life as a drudgery, thinking about the needs and the interests of other people as an unwelcome obligation. We don't get grace. We don't understand grace. And so I just think that there's a whole kind of constellation of things that operate in our hearts and in our minds. And when we get into these very practical issues that Paul raises about the life of grace, I think that like me, you will find yourself deeply and profoundly challenged by what does grace really mean in this relationship. What does grace really mean in terms of how do I view myself? What does grace really mean in terms of my value system? What does grace really mean in terms of what my ambitions in life are? What does grace really mean in how I approach God and how I interact with my own failures and my own limitations and my own desires and all these things that are so profoundly human? Grace is the coolest truth there ever was that you could ever consider. And so what is so striking to me, I guess, about the book of Galatians is that I don't know anywhere in the New Testament where just this application of grace just gets pounded deeper and deeper and deeper into our psyches as Paul defends the doctrine on the basis of the Old Testament itself and the revelation of Christ. It's not his opinion. It's what God has revealed, and there's an objective record of that. It's not about being good, as even the Old Testament makes that plain. It's about grace. And so I'm real excited to be diving into a study like that. I want to just end with a very brief summary of the key contrasts that more or less define this letter. Five crucial contrasts. I think these are big questions. These are the huge questions. These are the important questions to have resolved in our own mind and to feel like, I get it, I understand. I'm satisfied deeply with my awareness of these things. How do we approach God? What does God say about how do I approach Him? How do I gain my acceptability with God? You know, there are people who spend their entire lives feeling that there's nothing I can do to be acceptable to God. And in that sense, of course, they're right. But when they don't get grace, wow, how do you deal with that? There's the spiritual state that God says that we are in, independent of our knowledge of Christ through grace, and with that knowledge of Christ through grace, life and death. The real issues that Paul wants to get into, the real issues of life, having to do with what animates us, what drives us, the power to live, what enables you to move forward in your relationship with Christ and have that spill over into all the relationships you have. Those are such huge questions. And these are the things that this letter really addresses practically. 20 times in this letter, this is a 6-chapter letter, it's not that long. 20 times Paul brings up this contrast between approaching God on the basis of works and approaching God on the basis of faith. And he says these are completely irreconcilable. It's one way or the other. Either I approach God by what I do to earn or to deserve his acceptance, or I respond to what he has done for me by faith. What is faith? It's a reasoned choice to trust in the adequacy, not of ourselves, but of Christ. Faith and works. How do I gain acceptability with God? Well, 30 times out of this 6-chapter letter, Paul gets into the contrast between law and grace. My acceptability with God on the basis of law is conditional. Thou shalt and thou shalt not. And when there's a thou shalt and you shaltn't, I don't know what the contraction is for that. I didn't study Old English well enough. But you get the idea here. It's conditional. You fail, and therefore you're standing with God jeopardized. Versus grace, which says, no, you're standing before God has nothing to do with you. It's totally unmerited favor. It's a totally done deal. The spiritual state, Paul says, it's one of two things. You are either a slave in yourself, subject to your own limitations, your own desires, your own corrupt soul, or you will be able to experience on the basis of grace freedom. Freedom that transcends the limitations of self, because we're indwelt by the Spirit of God. And so God is interested not in modifying our behavior, but by grace affecting a process of inner revolution. I asked earlier, would you worry about prisoners from a supermax prison walking around the streets of Columbus? Right? Most of you thought, yeah, that'd be a problem. Okay? The reason that we worry about them, but we don't worry about other people, is because we've become aware that other people are not about the things that those people are about. Could you commit a violent crime? Could you do that? Could you do that? You could. You could. And maybe under certain conditions, you would. Okay. But it's like you're not driven by it. You're not motivated by that. You're not into that. You could do it. But you're finding satisfaction. You're finding significance and purpose. You're finding relationship. You're finding, a quality of life that's just not about those kinds of behaviors. And you know what? Here's the thing. If you understand the love of God, if you have experienced the love of God, if you are alive to God by His Spirit, you're not interested in just going and doing whatever you can get away with. Because that's, how satisfying is that? It's uncool. So God puts different desires in our hearts. We are animated by different things. And internally, we are driven to things that are really beautiful and fulfilling and are not about like what Paul says in chapter 5, where he says, through freedom, serve one another. That's where deep freedom really comes from, serving others. It is more blessed to give than to receive, and people who have decided to live that way find that out. The real issue is life and death. It's not about being good or being bad. Okay, that's not what Christianity is. Christianity is not a moral system. It's about life and death. Are you dead in yourself, or are you alive in God's Spirit? There's not like a middle ground there. It's, you can't be sort of pregnant, right? Either you is or you isn't. Are you alive in the Spirit based upon what Christ has done for you, and you're responding to that on the basis of faith, or are you dead in yourself? Those are the options. And that's why God addresses us as sons and daughters. There's a beautiful piece in chapter 4, we're going to get into that, where Paul describes just that dynamic. And then finally, the power to live. 24 times in this letter, Paul makes this contrast between the flesh and the Spirit. The flesh is self-effort, driven by my resources, my ability, my thing, versus being animated and filled with the Spirit of God, which begins to really take on profound change in our life. That's the end of Galatians 5, where he talks about the fruit of the Spirit of God. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to be getting into over the next several months. Man, I just think it is so beautiful and so cool to get in there and to deeply understand grace, to rethink this. What does grace really look like in my life? It will change your life in very profound ways. And I'll be sharing from week to week discoveries that I think God has led me to that have really helped me move toward Him and to find real transformation and change in my life, because the elements of grace that come out of this text and which God has really impressed upon my life. And I know that a lot of people have that same kind of experience as well. So I'm looking forward to sharing that together.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.